You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
And a semi-vaccinated Lionel Burney.
Semi-vaccinated, yes. There's not a needle ban on the Cycling Podcast, so I've had my first dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine, so anticipating feeling really unwell later on.
Hopefully the side effects don't hit you midway through the podcast, Lionel, and you'll be all right.
Which arm was
will
it?
Will people notice a difference if that is the case?
Sudden onset of curmudgeonly behaviour. I mean, most out of character, won't it? Is that one of the side effects?
Competition time. Win a tea towel if you spot the moment. Give us a time code at the moment at which the side effects begin to affect Lionel's performance.
Which shoulder was it, Lionel? Was it your gammy shoulder or was it the good shoulder?
No, I chose the good shoulder. Collarbone healing very well. Thanks to everyone who's sent me a message, by the way. Lots of people have mentioned it in their email correspondence to me. I haven't managed to reply to everyone, but well on the mend now. Thank you, Daniel. I can punch the air. That's the important thing.
That's handy.
There are even tentative noises about you now making an appearance at the Giro, which wasn't previously the case. So.
Well, we shall see what the spring brings. A big objective is a big ride in June. I'll hopefully be fit for that. More on that.
Well, we had our Giro d'Italia planning meeting the other day, didn't we, chaps? And some exciting things planned for that as ever. But it becomes a bit more real when we've had our planning meeting and Daniel's booked all the hotels and starting to look in a bit more detail at the route. So that's exciting and it's almost upon us. But there's lots of racing been going on. I mean, the headlines, Mark Cavendish is back, Tom Pidcock has arrived, everyone's favourite Pog Rog band was reunited for the Tour of the Basque Country, and we've also got a bit of a Flanders postscript in this week's episode as well. So there's lots to rattle through. Lionel, do you have a news roundup, please?
I do. You've nicked my headlines, Rich, there.
Well, you can just say them again, but in a different way.
Well, just on the Giro, we should just point out we'll be doing our usual daily coverage from the Giro d'Italia, and Kilometre Zero will return with 3 episodes each week as well. So make sure that you block out May the 8th to the 30th, I think the Giro is on, isn't it? So daily coverage from May the 8th with our Giro preview in the midweek before that. But we've still got some classics to go, haven't we? No Paris-Roubaix at the weekend, so a cobblestone-shaped hole in the weekend, but lots of other things going on. As you say, Richard, Tom Pidcock won his first race for Ineos Grenadiers at Brabantse-Pale in Belgium, out-sprinting Wout van Aert and Matteo Trentin. We'll talk about that in the first part of today's podcast. And Mark Cavendish, at the other end of his career, but rolled back the years with 3 stage wins in a row at the Presidential Tour of Turkey. And there were flashes of that form at Skelderprijs last week, where probably De Koninck Quickstep cocked up the finish a little bit, didn't they? Because they had Sam Bennett in second and Mark Cavendish in third behind the Alpecin Fenix rider Jasper Philipsen. And when you get 2 riders on the podium but don't make it onto the top step, there's usually a bit of an inquest. But Philipsen was just faster. Cavendish got his own back on Philipsen in Turkey, though, with 3 wins in a row, and Philipsen was second on each occasion. So we'll talk about Mark Cavendish's return to form and what this means for the rest of his season also in part one. There was also the women's Brabantse-Pale, and there was a photo finish with Ruth Winder getting the verdict ahead of Demi Vollering. But I don't know, Rich, I was looking at the same photos as everybody else, and it looked like the other way round. But what was the story?
Some people claiming this was Demi Vollering's Alaphilippe moment. He celebrated at Liège-Bastogne-Liège last year, didn't he, and lost the race. She celebrated, but not until she crossed the line. And I think her momentum was such that she really felt she'd won it. Studying the pictures, it looked to me like Vollering had won it, but if you look at all the possible angles, it's really impossible to say. And in an occasion like that, I think maybe a dead heat is the fairest answer. Joint first. I don't think that's very satisfactory, but I didn't see how you could really separate them at all. It's annoying from the point of view of the cycling podcast Femina, which came out last week, because we had an interview with Demi Vollering, and I tipped her for a big win soon. So look out for her at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, I think. She is she has stepped up a lot this year and is due a big win. And she thought she had it yesterday.
Well, back to the men's racing. We'll talk about the Tour of the Basque Country. It's Zulia, as it's now known. The Pog Rog Swingometer is now firmly pointing in Rog's direction after he turned the tables on the UAE Team Emirates riders on the final day. We'll dissect what was a fantastic week of racing in the Basque Country in part two of today's podcast. A very busy week for De Koninck Quickstep. Notwithstanding Mark Cavendish's three stage wins in Turkey, Fabio Jakobsen has made his comeback to racing after 7 months following that terrible crash at the Tour of Poland. He's been racing in Turkey, and there was a pile-up in the sprint finish on stage three, and there was a nice moment where Jakobsen went to check on the riders who'd hit the ground. It must have been a real sort of deja vu moment, hearing the sound of a finish line crash. Meanwhile, after... Patrick Lefevre seemed to suggest that the Wolf Pack was going to be hunted by Bora Hansgrohe's team boss. He's unveiled the news that Remco Evenepoel has extended his contract for 5 years and Julian Alaphilippe for 3 years. And Cavendish's third stage win in Turkey was the 800th team win since 2003. I've not actually verified Patrick Lefevre's arithmetic here, but if he says it's win number 800, well, that for now is good enough for me. Vinny Zabu, whose rider Matteo De Bonis tested positive for EPO recently, have withdrawn from the Giro d'Italia. Daniel, does that open the door for Gianni Savio's team?
Well, Lionel, last week, I think in the podcast, I suggested we'd heard from insiders at RCS, or good sources anyway, who know about what's going on at Giro HQ, and they said that RCS would rather castrate themselves than invite Gianni Savio after some of the comments he made when his team was initially snubbed. I spoke to Gianni shortly after that, and he suggested that wasn't the case. In fact, there was a sort of conspiratorial cackle at the end of Gianni's call, which suggested to me that their luck might be in. Anyway, we're recording now on, what day is it, chaps? It's Thursday. Isn't it? At lunchtime on Thursday, Vinny Zabu this morning announced that they are withdrawing from the Giro, of course. There was a chance they were going to be suspended right up until the start of the Giro, so they wouldn't be able to ride anyway. Has this opened the door for Gianni? I believe I've heard this morning that it probably has. So I expect some news on that front in the coming hours.
Well, one man whose Giro may well be in doubt is Vincenzo Nibali, who's won the race twice before. Of course, the Trek Segafredo rider had a crash in training and has broken a bone in his wrist and will require surgery. So with only a few weeks left before the start of the Giro in Turin, his participation looks in doubt. There's racing going on over the weekend at the Volta Valenciana in Spain. Miles Scottson won the opening stage there. He actually skidded off on a slippery bit of the run-in, but got back on his bike and held the gap over the chase group. An impressive solo win for the Australian there. And last week, or in the last episode, we spent a bit of time talking about the new UCI rules on littering and throwing bottles away. And I can't remember if I made this comment in the podcast or when we were talking about it before or afterwards. But it did seem to me, after the reaction to Michael Schaar being disqualified from the Tour of Flanders for throwing his bottle in the direction of spectators, that the rules might be relaxed. You know, that was one of the sort of unintended consequences, I guess, of the new littering rule. And lo and behold, the UCI has relaxed the penalties. So it's no longer a case of one drop and you're out. There's a kind of a traffic light system where it would take two or three offences before the penalties rack up. I have to say, in the Tour of the Basque Country, there was an incident on one of the stages where the riders entered the littering zone near the finish of the stage and all en masse kind of emptied their pockets. You know, they looked like they were deliberately littering.
It doesn't look good, does it?
It didn't look good at all.
It doesn't look good to the uninitiated, no.
No, and I think, again, this is one of those unintended consequences of making a rule that on the face of it has a good intent behind it. But if you were switching on the TV to just watch a bit of the cycling and you saw all the riders just dumping their waste on the road, not knowing that that was in the permitted littering zone, it doesn't reflect well on the sport. And I think perhaps the race organisers and broadcasters need to think about that. Perhaps there needs to be a graphic on the screen pointing out where the littering zones are, so that if you see anyone throwing stuff away, everyone's not taking to Twitter calling for disqualifications or penalties. There was also a good point on this made by Thomas de Gendt, the Lotto Soudal rider, asking about what, you know, if the riders are being penalised for littering, what about the publicity caravan? And we've all seen the stuff that the publicity caravan throws out. I mean, a lot of it isn't quite litter, but it's only really a few seconds away from being litter, because the stuff they throw out is pretty, crap, isn't it? I thought that was a
junk
good point.
Train, the junk train, as it's unaffectionately known as sometimes.
That's right. And one of the subjects of our Kilometre Zero at the Tour last year was did make mention of the littering from the publicity caravan and how that could be all tightened up. Anyway, that issue will no doubt run and run. Next week, we'll be doing two episodes, won't we, chaps? One on Monday after the Amstel Gold Race, which is on Sunday, and one after Flèche Wallonne in midweek. So we'll also be looking forward to Liège-Bastogne-Liège in the second of next week's episodes. And there's also the Tour of the Alps to look forward to. That starts on Monday.
With the debut, chaps, the Tour of the Alps, of Tony Paltzer, the Schemo sky running champion who's trying his hand. He's trying to do a ROG, and he's turned professional footballer, a hands grower. He's been training, I think, on Tenerife or Gran Canaria the last few weeks, and I'm very interested to see how he goes. Have we finished the roundup, Napalm?
Well, I was
is
just
this
ask,
the point
what,
at which...
What would be the most unusual crossover into professional cycling? I'm thinking, I don't know, trapeze artist to professional cyclist. I'd like to see that.
I was going to say ballroom dancing, but Mark Cavendish has already done that, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. No, that's the end of the news, Daniel. Have you got anything
to add?
That's
the end of the official roundup. I can interject at this point. No, just one bit of news that caught my eye over the last few days. The retirement, forced retirement of Romain Sicard, the climber, the French climber, rode for Total Direct Energy, spent many years at Europcar, turned pro at Westcartel. Now, this was a sort of poignant, sad story because he's had some kind of heart defect that's been diagnosed, or was diagnosed earlier this year. So he's had to retire. But interesting rider, turned pro amid a lot of fanfare. In 2009, there was a fantastic period for under 23 French riders where Thibaut Pinot, I think, won the Giro della Val d'Aosta, and then a week or two later Sicard won the Tour de l'Avenir. I interviewed him at that race, I remember, and then he won the World Championships in Mendrisio, and at that time a lot of people thought that Sicard was going to be the shining star in a golden French generation. Didn't quite work out like that, but became a very solid pro. He was one of those guys, I don't know if you chaps do this, sometimes at races you sort of observe riders, and Sicard was someone who never looked as though he was enjoying himself, didn't really smile very, very much. And I actually, based on that, wondered how long he was going to last as a pro. But appearances can be very deceiving. He carved out a long and very honourable career. So I think he's going to stay in cycling. So no doubt we'll be seeing him again in some other capacity.
He had a lot of health and injury problems, didn't he? I mean,
he did.
I remember speaking to Francois about him because we expected great things from him. He was looked to be a super talent and never delivered on that at all. A French Basque rider as well, wasn't he? One other little bit of news that caught my eye pertaining to these new UCI rules. Alexander Richardson of Alpecin Phoenix was disqualified after Tour of Turkey Stage 3, I think, for using the hands draped over the bars position. I think that is being inconsistently enforced, that rule, it seems. Watching the footage of him, he had his pinky finger resting on the brake levers, but his wrists definitely leaning on the tops of the bars. So disqualified, you know, seems a bit harsh, but there you go. He was sitting in the front of the bunch at the time. So whether that will be applied to some bigger names, bigger stars, let's wait and see, shall we?
Well, yeah, at the Tour, you know, they take out Tim de Klerk first, and then whoever's behind him, take him out until there's, you know, only one rider left, and Henri de Grange will get his wish long after.
Who will be that, the last man in the bunch?
Who rides down the back these days? I don't know.
Now that Steve Cummings has retired.
one of the Yates brothers, probably.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast, team car, the back of the pack, please.
That said, PK, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting this week's episode to remind us to tell you that it's sponsored by LinkedIn Jobs. Now, small businesses have always shown an incredible ability to adapt, innovate and survive, even more so this past year. Now, another way you can adapt and grow is by finding the right people to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs helps you to do that for free. And we know that to our benefit because we took advantage of the offer that I'm about to read out recently, advertising for a new producer of our new Spanish language podcast presented by Rob Hatch and Laura Messiger, El Cycling Podcast. We were looking for a producer with the right skills, obviously, living in the right place. We were looking for someone in Madrid. Really quite narrow skills, but we put an advert on LinkedIn Jobs and were able to specify exactly who we were looking for or the type of person we were looking for, and got a flood of very good candidates. We were able to select somebody from that, and he's been a fantastic addition to that team and has been doing a really good job, as you'll know if you've been listening to El Cycling Podcast. So LinkedIn Jobs was really a huge benefit to us in really targeting an advert and finding the right person. LinkedIn is an active community of professionals with more than 30 million members in the UK. Getting started is easy, and their new features can help you find qualified candidates quickly. Post a job with targeted screening questions, and they'll quickly get your role in front of qualified candidates. Manage job posts and contact candidates from a single view on the familiar LinkedIn.com website as functions are streamlined onto one simple screen. And now you can do all this from your mobile device no matter where the day takes you. That's how LinkedIn Jobs can help you hire the right person faster. When your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. And now you can post a job for free. Just visit linkedin.com/cycle. Again, that's linkedin.com/cycle to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Well, chaps, I'm sure like me, you watched Brabantse Pijl yesterday and saw a pretty stunning victory by Tom Pidcock. He's been promising or threatening something. You know, he's turned professional this year. He's still only 21 with exquisite timing. Mitch Docker's latest episode of Life in the Peloton was released on Wednesday morning, and it was a very, very interesting chat with Tom Pidcock. I found it really interesting.
On the subject of contentious UCI rules that we discussed in the news roundup,
are you going to socks?
I was going to mention the old sock rule, which is often lampooned on social media. Yeah. Do you know what? I don't even know if it's still a rule. Is it still a rule?
Yeah, but I think so.
It struck me that Tom Pidcock's, he might be sailing quite close to the wind with the length of those socks.
He's wearing this kind of socks that I used to wear when you were able to take long haul flights. Yeah, very long socks. I mean, that Matthew van der Poel is similar. He wears these very long socks as well. It might be a cyclocross thing, but anyway, Pidcock, a coming of age victory for him, you could say. He's been threatening it. You know, he was very impressive at Strada Bianca and then at Milan San Remo as well. I thought he then looked quite tired in some of the other races, Tour of Flanders, for example, and some of the cobbled classics around that time. But obviously in great form and coming into some other races that might suit him very well indeed. And to beat Wout van Aert in the sprint in the way that he did. Remember, a guy who's won bunch sprints, who's one of the fastest sprinters in the world. Okay, Pidcock said afterwards that a sprint from a small group like that at the end of a race is not, you know, it's a little bit of a different proposition. But it looked to me like Van Aert was most concerned about Trentin in that sprint and really went to some lengths to neutralise him by, you know, cutting quite close and then cutting him off. And Pidcock got the advantage of coming from behind Van Aert and winning incredibly convincingly in the end. It wasn't even close.
It was another example, chaps, I don't know if you'd agree, of Wout van Aert almost looking sort of confused by his own embarrassment of riches as far as different talents and abilities and ways to win races is concerned. He almost, he rides like a guy who can't sprint when in actual fact he is the fastest sprinter in pretty much every race that he does.
Well, I think, and Pidcock made this point as well, that Van Aert was pulling really hard all day. And I've noticed this in Van Aert. I should say at this point, we've gotten in a bit of trouble this year for talking too much about Van Aert and Van Der Poel in races that they haven't actually won. That's a fair point. But they are very interesting riders to watch, and often they are the favourites and the guys around whom other riders are basing their races. But I've noticed with Van Aert that he assumes a lot of responsibility in a lot of races, and the best race he's ridden all year was Gent-Wevelgem, where he really exercised a lot of patience and he had a teammate in the breakaway, and he didn't take on the responsibility of driving it the break clear, you know, and building the advantage and really just doing too much, showing his cards too early. And Pidcock sort of alluded to this in his post-race interview, that he felt Van Aert had just done too much all day and probably took something away from his sprint in the end.
Yeah, I mean, Van Aert was very prominent, but we can't take anything away from Matteo Trentin, who really opened up the race by getting off the front on his own. And Tom Pidcock took responsibility when he needed to. I mean, he really rode decisively to get himself into a position to win, and then, you know, wasn't panicked on the final climb. I've got to say, I really enjoyed that final climb. I thought it was a bit more of a sort of sporting finish compared to the one that we saw last year, where Julian Alaphilippe got the better of Van der Poel and Benoit Cosnefroy, I think it was, in the finish. But no, Pidcock, this has been coming, really, hasn't it? Third at Koerner, Brussels Koerner, was the first of the sort of real eye-catching results, and then rode very, very well at Strade Bianche and finished fifth. And then in Milan-San Remo, you know, he did take responsibility on the descent of the Poggio, didn't he? Probably did a bit too much or used his effort in slightly the wrong place. And then I agree with you, Richard, in those the sort of the three classics, the cobbled classics, E3, Dwarsdorf Flanders, and the Tour of Flanders, you know, he was kind of there or thereabouts. Certainly in the Tour of Flanders, he looked to be in a fantastic position just as it all was kind of kicking off and the winning move went away, and he just wasn't in the right position at the right time there. And I did wonder whether, you know, sort of 6 weeks of racing at the sharp end had caught up with him. But, you know, 9-10 days off, just maybe throttle back a little bit and refocus. And now we'll see what he can do in Amstel Gold and Flèche Wallonne, which he is on the start list to do. I mean, Daniel, I think you can already see the sort of similarity. I think we can all see the similarities physically to Julian Alaphilippe, but also in the way he kind of rides the bike. You know, there are some physical similarities, not just in stature, but in the way he moves on the bike, Tom Pidcock. And clearly, you know, a talent. He's a fast rider. Daniel, you often talk about this notion of riders being fast, and it kind of sounds a bit crazy because they're all fast, obviously. But he's just got that leg speed, and he really opened up that sprint on the final climb yesterday to great effect. And perhaps it was Van Aert looking a bit leggy, because he's been at the focus has been on him so much for so long now, that maybe he was there for the taking a little bit on that final climb, and Pidcock didn't let the opportunity go. Fantastic debut win for him.
Speaking of fast riders, chaps, I think, well, there's some competition, but the story of the week has been arguably the fastest rider of the last 20 years. Mark
Andre Greipel.
Well, funnily enough, it did occur to me this week that, so I looked at the dates of Mark Cavendish's first win for T-Mobile, and that was in 2007. It was April 2007. And I looked to see if the dates coincided exactly, his win at Skelderprijs in 2007 and his first win in Turkey the other day. And it doesn't quite, but that whole period in 2007, there was a stretch of a few weeks where Cavendish and Greipel, well, it was a pretty one-sided kind of rivalry or animosity at that point, but Cavendish was getting very upset about the team riding for Greipel. They were both on the same team at the time, and then eventually Cavendish got his breakthrough at Skelderprijs, and from that point on he was very much the senior one of the two, and sometimes Greipel was leading him out. And yeah, so 14 years later.
Just putting that in context, I mean, does that, you know, could we in 2035 still be talking about Tom Pidcock and Pogacar? It's conceivable. It's conceivable. Extraordinary. Don't get me started on Greipel and Cavendish and any that kind of rivalry when it was at its height back in the HTC High Road days. But how do we contextualize Cavendish's three wins? Because as you say, Daniel, it has been the story of the week. And I think the presence of Jasper Philipsen, genuinely one of the fastest young sprinters in the world, has helped to elevate Cavendish's wins there, or at least add quite a lot of gloss to them, because, you know, these are not easy wins that he's taking, and the way that he's been winning them has been impressive. It's not the Cavendish of old. There's a difference there. There's a kind of, it looks to me, he's operating, you know, on a higher gear, more power than speed, perhaps. But he's definitely got his mojo back. And, you know, I even noticing the way that he's crossed the line and been cautiously lifting his arms, that could be something to do with the road surfaces, or, you know, it's so long since he's done that, that it's been quite striking that he's been very gingerly raising his arms in victory. Although the other day, after the first one, there was a train line just beyond the finish line that he had to negotiate as well. So not easily done. But how do we make sense of these wins? How do we contextualise them? What do they actually mean in terms of Cavendish getting back to competitive form?
I can feel the bouncing ball bouncing in my direction there, Rich, and sort of bouncing up sort of chin high as I try and bring it down.
Here's
under
Lionel
control.
To pour some cold water on the story of the week.
Hang on a minute. I mean, first of all, this is Cavendish's first race victory since February 2018, when he won a stage of the Dubai Tour. You know, it's a long way back to his last, you know, really big win, which was stage 14 of the Tour de France in 2016. You know, we're coming on for 5 years. It's been a real drought for, as you say, Daniel, the fastest man in cycling over the last 20 years. Arguably, at his peak, would anyone have been faster than Mark Cavendish in the history of the sport? I mean, you know, that's something we probably could work out, but, you know, certainly one of, if not the greatest sprinters of all time. But as you were mentioning the rivalry there with André Greipel from their days in the same team, there was a very ear-catching quote from Cavendish in which he was trying to assert his supremacy over Greipel when it came to getting selected and getting the train put in front of him for the Grand Tours. He said, "If I wanted to get shit small wins, I'd race shit small races." That's a direct quote from Cavendish, right? Okay,
it is a direct quote, and it was one that was gathered by me, and it was one that I lived to regret. And I can remember vividly, I was in the middle of Courtrick in the fairground doing a phone interview with Cavendish. He was at the hairdresser's. It was on the phone, and he did definitely say that. I wrote it in the Guardian, and he didn't like the reaction to the quote, did he, Daniel? I mean, you know this very well. He didn't speak to me for a while after that, actually.
Well,
he did say it.
Well, he may not appreciate me bringing it up again. I mean, but it was a fair comment in the context, wasn't it? I mean, a man who had his eyes set on winning the biggest races in the world, he didn't want anything getting in the way of that. No problem with that quote, you know, even shorn of context. I think that's absolutely fine. And I'm not saying that the Presidential Tour of Turkey is a shit small race either, by the way, but I am saying that if you look beyond Jasper Philipsen, who is very fast, the sprinting field does drop off quite dramatically, and the depth of the field drops off quite dramatically as well. And you know, it isn't like winning even you know, a World Tour stage race, you know, a sprint in a World Tour stage race. So, you know, there's steps to go, but the signs are encouraging, and I think that's the big question. You know, what?
So glad you put that shovel down.
What could this be?
I'm so glad.
What could this be the first step towards? Could we see Mark Cavendish back in a Grand Tour later this year? I mean, he's slated to do the Vuelta at the end of the summer, and not currently in De Koenig Quickstep's plans for either the Giro or the Tour. They have Sam Bennett, of course, as their number one sprinter. But where does Cavendish go from here? Because clearly he's got his mojo back to some degree, because getting across the line first in any professional bike race is not easy. And so take nothing away from, you know, consistently delivering 3 days in a row.
I mean, I think we can look forward and we can speculate about what's in the future. But, you know, this week, I think a lot of us have just been struck by, well, we've felt that this has been such a significant development because of where he's come from in the last 3 and 4 years and what a torturous process it's been. And there's been a lot of talk about belief, Cavendish, you know, keeping his belief, maintaining his belief and confidence throughout the whole process. But, you know, if we're honest, I think a lot of us had lost a lot of faith, and certain people had definitely lost all of their faith in Cavendish. And, you know, my kind of approach over the last 2 or 3 years with him has been to really pay attention to what his closest allies and closest supporters have been saying and thinking. You know, people like Rolf Aldag, who his direct sportif at T-Mobile, Rod Ellingworth, his first mentor and coach at the British Cycling Academy. And even in them and people like them over the past 3 or 4 years, I've sort of reluctantly kind of observed a waning, perhaps, of the faith of that kind of immediate entourage. And that has led me to sort of question whether he would ever get back to anything like this level. And then, you know, you look at other things, you know, I was looking at other top sprinters, Pataki, McEwen, Cipollini, Greipel, and when did they stop winning? You know, Pataki won his last Grand Tour stage at 37, McEwen at 35, Cipollini at 36. Cavendish is going to be 36 in May. So that was another reason not to believe. And then, you know, I listened to things that Mark was saying, all sort of reasons for him not to win that seemed legitimate at first. The illness, the Epstein-Barr illness that really hampered him in 2017-2018. But then, you know, there were issues with his bike, for example, at Dimension Data. There was a lot of talk about, I don't think it was any secret, that he was not happy with his Cervelo bike. I remember him telling me one day that he'd been training with Alberto Bettiol, who was riding for BMC at the time, and he'd had a go on Bettiol's bike, and he said it almost brought him to tears how the difference between the bikes at that time. But then the following season he was on a BMC bike for Dimension Data and he still wasn't winning. So, you know, as time went by, you kind of felt that it was the boy crying wolf, or it could be, but when in fact I think it was the boy crying wolf pack. He wanted to be back at that. He wanted to be back in the environment where one of the environments where he'd last thrived. And, you know, that belief, it was very striking, and it started to seem a little bit incongruous. I mean, chaps, I think we'll hear now, you'll remember it well, a conversation I had with him at the start of 2019, and it had been a year since his last win in Dubai. And even at this stage, it looked as though possibly he was starting to flog a dead horse. But this is what he told me then.
I mean, like, I know if I put the work in, I'm the best. No matter what people think, if you're being ill or not. Like, if I'm healthy and I put the work in, I'm better than anybody else. Like, I don't see...
Still think that?
I don't see how you can dispute it. I don't see how you can dispute it. Tell me when I've ever put the work in and not being ill and not being better than everybody else. Tell me, Daniel. Go on.
Well, as a counterpoint to that, you've always said, I remember back when you were 23, 24, you've always predicted that you would lose speed, maybe earlier than some sprinters because of the way you sprint and because you relied a lot on leg speed. So, you know, that might be one factor that people are considering when they imagine that you could have lost it, you could have fallen off a cliff.
Well, I did all that in 2016. And then got ill in 2017. Do you just lose it like that overnight? I don't think you just lose it overnight, do you? Do you? I don't know.
We'll see.
Your trainer? did tell me, go and ask someone, I don't know. I don't think you just lose it from one day to the next, you just lose it. It doesn't happen. I'm sorry. I haven't studied physiology at uni, but you cannot just lose it from one day to the next. It's not possible. It's not possible.
So that was him sounding, that was Cavendish sounding as pugnacious and belligerent as in his pomp in 2019. As I said before, over, you know, the following year, you know, he still wasn't managing to get the results. He was sort of let go really by Bahrain, Merida, or didn't renew his contract. And then we thought he was going to retire, didn't we? At the end of last year when he finished Gent-Wevelgem and he was in tears. So faced with this turnaround, I've been really curious to know just what has happened and what has happened to Cavendish the athlete, because we said he's 36 in May, getting to definitely the autumn of any rider's career. So how is it that he's suddenly looking back to his sprightly and very fast best? One man who's been instrumental, very instrumental, I think, in that transformation has been his new coach, who is a Greek gentleman, coach at De Koninck Quick Step, called Vasilis Antastopoulos. And I spoke to Vasilis today. He was on his way back from, or he was on his way to Malaga Airport, I believe, from a training camp with the De Koninck Giro team in the Sierra Nevada in the south of Spain.
I'm going to be honest with you. We had a meeting in December, and just after 10 minutes, I saw that I had to do with a teenager, not with a guy who's 36 old, years old, and that everybody thought that he's finished. You know, the way that he was expressing to me what he has been through the whole the last 3 years, the mistakes that he thought that he has done with the previous teams, the desire on his eyes, the fire in his eyes, as we say, he was having something incredible. So from that moment on, I took it personally, you know. I made a personal bet with myself that, okay, Cav is a big champion. I have to do everything I can to make him win again. I just asked him to trust me 100% and just to go for it. I saw some, in my opinion, big mistakes that he has been doing in training. So I just completely changed his training routine. And I had a podcast from a really well-recognized coach who said that, you know, guys, Cav's not going to win any race from now on. He's finished. And I called Cav and said, Cav, look, you know, listen to what people think. What do you think? He said, ah, mate, we're going to do it. You know, we as a team, we really believe in Cav, because the team knew Cav already since for a long time. So we tried to improve his position on the bike. We gave him the best bike in the world. He started with Almeria. He had a flat tire last 3Ks. And then had two second places, one third place. He was up there, and also in the Belgian races, he was up there in the final, while previous years, either he was with Grupetto or he was just, you know, DNF in the race. So that shows to us that he was getting close and we just missed a little bit. And I think, you know, this week in Turkey, he proved to everybody that. I don't say that he was, you know, they did mistakes with the previous coaches. So I think everybody tried to make him a better rider.
And Vasilis, I guess you've probably got access to his physiological data from the first time he was with the team in 2015, I suppose. If we were to compare his data then to now, what differences, if any, would we see?
We can see now that he has a slightly better peak power, but the duration of his sprint is better now than previously. So now he can also hold his sprint for a longer period of time than previously. His, you know, his threshold and his aerobic capacity is almost the same as it used to be in the past. But now he's sprinting better right now.
Well, interesting to hear from Cavendish's new coach. I should say, just before we talk briefly on that the quote, the famous quote from Cavendish from all those years back, what he objected to was the suggestion that that Greipel was winning shitty small races. He claimed that he didn't say that that's what Greipel was doing. He said, if I wanted to win shitty small races, I'd ride shitty small races. And Mark, if you're listening, I'm delighted to see you back on the top step of the podium again.
Oh, my
but
word.
No, it is great. No, it is. I think people have enjoyed that, though. It has been a great story, as you said, Lionel.
Well, it's a reminder, chaps, I think, as well, isn't it, of just how big a figure he was in the sport. You think back to around 2009, 2010, he was really the biggest name in the sport, and that's been obvious, really, from the reaction and the amount that these victories have resonated this week. That's the size of his imprint on the sport.
And that toothy smile has been missing. You know, there's such a distinctive Cavendish look when he wins that has been absent because he's not had much to smile about. And it does kind of roll back the years for all of us watching. There's a certain nostalgia in seeing, you know, Cavendish with his head down, his jaw jutting out, and that big toothy grin. It has been missing, and it's been funny to see it.
And really striking there, champs, to hear his coach Vasilis suggesting that, well, not only is he performing at the same level as he was in 2015, maybe even better, and you can't help but think, if that is the case, that this isn't just a sort of sentimental swan song, that who knows, he could be a force to be reckoned with, well, not just this season, but beyond this season. I don't think, you know, there are people suggesting that he might now be in with a shout for a place at the Tour de France. I don't think that's even remotely the case, but he may do a Grand Tour this year.
Before we move on to the Basque Country, Lionel, bit of business?
Yes, well, we ran a competition, didn't we, last week, to win a set of Jaybird Vista sport headphones, wireless sport headphones, which I'm actually using at the moment. Very good they are too. And the competition was to answer a very simple question. We asked, who finished second to Alejandro Valverde when Valverde won his first ever pro race at the Tour of the Basque Country in 2003? The answer, of course, was Davide Rebellin, who is still racing as well, even older than Valverde. And the lots and lots of entries, almost all of whom were correct. So I think Pro Cycling Stats obviously got hammered last week as people looked up the 2003 Tour of the Basque Country results. Congratulations to Helen Patrick. Your headphones are on your way and hopefully will be with you by the time you hear this. Richard also did a competition.
I'm sure Helen didn't look it up on Pro Cycling Stats line on, and I'm sure she'll object to the insinuation.
That's true.
She did.
Well, that's not cheating. You were allowed to look up the answer if you wanted. I mean, that's fine. I mean, it was a fairly obscure question. If people knew off the top of their head...
Put your shovel down again.
What I'm saying is that 99% of people got the answer correct, which surprised me if they were all just going off their own cycling memory, because I wouldn't have known that had I not looked it up. Anyway.
But we ran another competition, didn't we?
We did. To win one of our fantastic tea towels designed by Simon Scarsbrook, and Richard, the winner of the competition, had to name the piece of music that was in your Tour of Flanders montage. The piece of music was...
It was actually the Gent-Wevelgem montage.
That's right,
montage.
It was, sorry.
The music was Flowers of the Forest. Flowers of the Forest. And you've got the winner there, Lionel?
The winner is Neil Marklew. And I will get that tea towel in the post this week. Just an update on the Friends of the Podcast gifts that are coming. We are still waiting on a delivery of the casquettes. We're waiting for them to come from Italy, where they've been manufactured. Manufacturing has been hampered by coronavirus, so I don't think they're working at full capacity. So they're a little bit later than we had hoped, but they are on their way. And as soon as they arrive, I will clear the backlog because my posting arm is now back to full strength. So if you are waiting for a cap, it won't be too much longer now.
And you can get a cap and a tea towel, or either, by signing up as a Friend of the Podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Lionel, you released your chat with Magnus Backstead last week. That was a very, very nice listen. The next Friends of the Podcast special will be the first installment of our Young Riders Diaries, Joe Laverick, Red Walters, and Marjolein van de Geloof. That will be out next week, and we'll introduce you to those three young diarists properly next week as well. But onto the Basque Country, a really cracking race. It often is. Lots of fans there as well, which is really an essential feature of racing in the Basque Country, but it was quite strange to see, especially when the racing in Belgium has been fan-free largely. But a great race, another showdown between Rog and Pog, Primož Roglič and Tadej Pogačar. And it was as you say, the swingometer is back in Rog's favour. It didn't look like that earlier in the week because Brandon McNulty of Team UAE Emirates took over the leader's jersey at one point, a teammate obviously of Pogacar, and it seemed that they bet on McNulty to win the race. Pogacar, when there was a split on the final day and Roglic was in the front half of the race, Pog stayed with McNulty to try and help him back. That kind of backfired. And in the end, Rog took the overall. David Gaudu won the stage. We heard, actually, if you watched the live coverage without commentary, you could hear the conversation between Gaudu and Rog about, you know, the stage and whether Gaudu would be allowed to win it. And Rog said, yeah, I don't care about that. So Gaudu was obviously then able to commit to helping Rog stay away, and he did. But I think there are three questions I wanted to put to you, chaps. The first one is, did Jumbo-Visma, who have been criticised in the past for their tactics, including at the Tour de France last year, did they play a blinder in giving the jersey to Brandon McNulty? And giving is in inverted commas there.
Well, yeah, it should be in inverted commas, because I don't believe that was some great strategic plan. How many days earlier was it? 2 or 3 days earlier when, Vingegaard stayed with McNulty. And, you know, they had Rog just sort of nestling, was it 20 seconds behind McNulty going into the final day, and the theory being that they didn't want to work the following day and they didn't want to have the weight of the race on their shoulders either going into the final day, and it really put a target on McNulty's back. I don't think that it was some piece of wizardry. I think, you know, as brilliant as Rog's performance was on the final day, and as brilliantly as everything worked out, there were so many imponderables there. There were so many moving parts in that final stage that there was a lot of luck involved. Notably, the key piece of action was really something that Astana provoked, and particularly Alex Aramburu's descent or attack on the descent about 80 kilometers from the finish, and that was what allowed the original gap to open up between Rog and Pog and McNulty as well, and that was really what caused chaos in the UAE ranks, and from that point, you know, everything turned on. Well, it turned on a dime on multiple, or it could have turned on a dime on multiple occasions. In those last 80 kilometers, there were so many just sort of fragments of action where it could have gone either way. And I'm sure there are probably some things we don't know about what happened, some untold stories of that final stage. It could literally have come down to, you know, whether Pogacar and McNulty were able to hear their radio at certain points, and, you know, how clear the message was that was coming back from the car. But I don't believe that it was necessarily a piece of strategic brilliance by Jumbo-Visma, although that's how it looked with 2020 hindsight.
Let me put the next question to you, Lionel, can I? You might be able to roll in something from that first question. What are the lessons for UAE Team Emirates? Because what it seems to me they were trying to do here was to ride as a team. And, you know, given the way that Pog won the Tour last year when he did so without a team, that is probably a question that they're asking themselves. How would they cope in a scenario where he really does need a team? And it seemed to me that was part of the effort here in the Basque Country, to really ride as a team. But so what are the lessons from it? Are there valuable lessons from what happened?
I mean, it didn't work out for them, but I don't think they did anything too badly wrong, really. I mean, you know, McNulty had the leader's jersey and they had to back McNulty for as long as they could. They probably stuck with him too long, and letting Roglic get up the road was obviously a significant mistake. But you have to bear in mind, going into that final stage, Roglic was ahead of Pogacar overall by 20 seconds already. So to win the race with Pogacar, they would have had to, they probably could have ditched McNulty a bit earlier, maybe reacted more strongly to the danger posed by Roglic, and then had a shootout between Pogacar and Roglic, and then probably the overall result would have been the same. Roglic would have won the race, I suspect. I mean, Pogacar did, try to close that gap. And Richard, when we were talking about this before, you made the point that he got very close and then started kind of looking for a bit more assistance from other riders. And there wasn't the cooperation to bring the gap back. But I don't really think that they defended the jersey in a conventional way, I felt, particularly going over that big climb that McNulty lost contact on. I suspect it would have been very different had Pogacar been in the leader's jersey. For a start, Roglic wouldn't have been given quite the same leeway because Pogacar would have been able to react himself, whereas McNulty clearly wasn't able to. So they were trying to nurse McNulty in, weren't they? And it was a long way from the finish, 40-odd kilometres.
But Lionel, you said that you thought they could have ditched him earlier. I thought they ditched him. I mean, Pogacar ditched him almost immediately. And the genius there of what Roglic did was that he reacted immediately. And this is why, you know, I say that in certain respects, it could have come down to literally, you know, how well the message or how quickly the message was being relayed from the team car. Because it seemed to me as though Roglic had got that message instantly that McNulty was being dropped. And he accelerated and it was literally, it was a 100-meter gap at that point between him and Pogacar. And he managed to extend it or maintain it. And that was what ended up winning him the race, although he couldn't have predicted that at the moment. But I mean, I thought that that there was a decision to be made at the bottom of the descent where Pogacar had been gapped and McNulty had also been gapped. I thought at that point Diego Lisi and Rafał Majka had pulled almost to the top of the previous climb. They must have been close by, and they could probably then they could probably have caught up, or if Pogacar and McNulty had waited, if they, as you say, if they were really determined to ride as a team the whole way. And there were also occasions later after the Krabbelin climb when McNulty had been gapped where Pogacar still had the option potentially to wait for McNulty, because I think, you know, most people looked at it and they thought McNulty had completely collapsed. And he'd completely fallen out of contention. That wasn't necessarily the case. He actually rode a pretty strong stage. He had a hard moment on a very steep climb that he didn't really suit. But, you know, they could have gone to greater efforts to stay together as a homogenous unit. But I think, you know, they're going to learn a lot from this. Pogacar is going to learn a lot from it. But by the same token, I think Roglic will have learnt a lot from both his experience in the Basque Country and Paris-Nice, because there's been a lot of adversity, and he's also had a young team in the Basque Country, not really his Tour de France team. So I think that's going to stand him in really good stead.
Well, that was my final question. I guess Pog showed his inexperience, I think, didn't he, by sort of being caught between a rock and a hard place, deciding initially to help McNulty and then deciding to ditch McNulty, but not fully committing to it and looking around and expecting help from riders who were never going to give him help. I mean, there was a fantastic moment where when he turned around looking for help, the rider on his wheel was Jonas Vingegaard. Sorry for the pronunciation. Here's Emma Norsgaard with the correct pronunciation.
Jonas Vingegaard.
But Vingegaard, to mispronounce his name again, was obviously perfectly positioned to help to help Roglic. And he just shrugged his shoulders when Pogacar was looking for help. I mean, Jumbo-Visma were in obviously a very strong position with quite a young and inexperienced team. What are the conclusions then, Lionel, for Rog and Jumbo-Visma? You know, here they are. They kind of went toe-to-toe with UAE, who could well be their main rivals at the Tour de France as well, and they came out on top. So what do they take away from it?
I think they take away from it racing a slightly different way. Again, we go back to last year in the Tour de France, and the sense that Roglic was strong enough to really put people to the sword earlier in the race, but was riding relatively conservatively and gobbling up the time bonuses and trying to win the Tour that way. And in the end, it turned out not to be enough. And, you know, this was an opportunity to strike a bit of a blow against Pogacar, put him on the back foot, remind him that if they have to go head to head, that he's got he's got plenty in the tank, hasn't he? And I think the one thing about all of these races, I mean, it was a fantastic watch all week. Every stage was entertaining, and it's it's a bit like when we were talking about the classics, how the Saxo Bank Grand Prix in Harelbeke was, you know, a real humdinger of a race, and the Tour of Flanders, to my mind, didn't quite catch on. And we get to the Tour de France, and we expect this sort of open warfare type racing across all of the mountains, and it doesn't happen as often. You know, we saw five pretty compelling days of racing in the Basque Country, and then my explanation for that is that the stakes aren't quite as high. You know, it's not all or nothing, is it? If Roglic had tried something and it hadn't worked out, and he'd been, you know, pipped, it wouldn't have been the end of the world. And so I think it was just sort of, you know, a flurry of kind of early blows in as the hostilities head towards the Tour de France. And they'll have no doubt have learned something, but I'm not anticipating Jumbo-Visma to necessarily rip up their blueprint and go on the attack with, you know, with Roglic and Vingegaard, or, you know, Van Aert or whoever else they have in their Tour de France lineup to make life difficult. I think it will, the intensity will be turned up that extra notch and a half, and you know, the strength and weakness of the two main riders will be what it comes down to. Because as you always say, Richard, if you've got the strongest team, that's great, but if you haven't got the strongest rider, then it doesn't really matter so much.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and at the checkout enter the code SISCP25. If they're running another bigger discount at the time, that the code won't work, but with non-discounted items, SISCP25 will get you 25% off. And if you have a question for James Morton at Science and Sport, email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Last call out for questions, because I'm going to go to him very soon with all the questions that we have. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And we've got an interesting collaboration coming up with Science and Sport for the Giro d'Italia, which we'll tell you about closer to the time. Now for everyone's favourite part of the podcast, it's Slow Radio, and thanks very much for all your submissions. We've been getting loads of emails with your audio files. We want to be transported somewhere, wherever you happen to be riding, and yeah, we've had some great submissions. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com is the place to send them. This week's comes from Josiah Bournazian, an award-winning saxophonist, composer, educator, electronic musician, and a visual artist, a painter. I had a look at his website, but have a listen to Josiah's music as well. It's wonderful. He's put together a sample of the unique experience of cycling in the deep south of Texas near the USA-Mexico border. We were going to just do a little Flanders postscript. And this was triggered in a way by the question last week. You asked, or one of you asked, who had the better Cobbled Classics campaign? Was it Wout van Aert or Mathieu van der Poel? The answer I should have given was Casper Asgreen, because, you know, not the correct answer in that context, obviously, given the question. But, you know, he won E3, he won the Tour of Flanders, and probably didn't get the credit he deserved, because so much of our focus and attention is on those two Galacticos. Asgreen flies under the radar a little bit, but he's a tremendously talented rider, very I enjoy watching Asprey on the bike. He's got these long arms. He just seems to sort of ooze power, and that was evident at E3, also then at the Tour of Flanders, and the strength in the sprint as well to beat Mathieu van der Poel in the way that he did. Very, very impressive indeed. And you spoke to Brian Holm of De Koninck Quickstep. He's a sort of semi-retired sports director now, isn't he? He doesn't do so many days with the team, but he's a fellow Dane. He knows Asgreen well, and I think he discovered him for the team, did he, Lionel?
Well, sort of. Let's hear from Brian Holm, shall we?
To be honest, I cannot say I was the guy who discovered him, because, you know, you have a lot of phone calls always from riders, but was it Bjarne Riis who called me about Kasper? Was it Kasper who called me himself? Or was it his sports director, Michael Skilde of Virtu? But of course, it was getting more and more intense. And I remember talking with Kasper already the year before, when he had an offer from Education First, whatever it was called, Garmin. And they sort of, I wouldn't say flake him, but something went wrong. I think they took a Norwegian or a Swedish instead. Probably Education First, when I had that, they took a Swedish guy, Magnusson, instead. I think, so he was like the year before, he was close, but he didn't get the pro contract. So when Skelde, Riis, or Kasper started, so I spoke to all of them. Of course, with Danish riders, I called the managers, the people. I called his son years from the past, from the under 23, even from the juniors. And I spoke to Bjarne Riis about him, and his manager, former manager of the YouTube Pro, you know, Bjarne's old team, said, "Brian, I'm going to stick my hand in the fire for that kid. It's going to be good." And then I thought, now it's time to call Patrick about him. So we're texting him, you know, Patrick Lefebvre. He's not the guy you come and offer. He signed him the day after. I said to Patrick, or to Kasper, I said, "Kasper, that can take a while, you know, when you start with Patrick Lefebvre." So we started, and I remember second or third time I called about Kasper, because he already had a written offer, Kasper, at his desk. You know, when an offer is like normally running like 2 weeks, then it expires, so he doesn't shop around with it, okay? So so everything happened within 2 weeks. And at a certain moment, I call in Patrick saying, "Now, I think, Patrick, could we make decisions now?" And he was like, "Patrick can be, you calling me? Bjarne Riis calling me? Everybody calling me about him. You have to wait. I don't know yet." And they are so, that's going to be tight. And I remember I called Kasper, who said, you know, he's not an easy guy. He's honest, Patrick, but not always easy. So I would start to think about to sign that contract, because I cannot promise you Patrick going to take you with Quickstep. And he said, "No, I want to wait. I take the chance." I said, "Well, are you playing with your life? Because somebody flicked you last year, Kasper." "Yes, but I only want to ride for Quickstep," he said. Okay, give another 3-4 days, you know. And then about the same time, we had that accident, or they did, Bob Jungs, Laurent Depuis, and Vakoc with the truck in South Africa. A quite bad injury, all of them. And three men down, Patrick calling, "I'm going to take him. We need one more rider." The first year when I remember he did Adriatica, Italian race, calling him like, after the stage, "How are you doing? How did it?" I knew Viviani won, but just to hear how it worked in the team, you know, he was happy, you know, stuff like that. Having like, let's talk now, 15, 20 minutes. Later that evening, before I went to bed, I saw the race report of the team, of the doctor. Then I could see, basically, when I called him, he would have been straight back from the hospital. He would have crashed very hard, having 8 stitches in his face. So when I called him, he's just back from the hospital. after a high-speed crash with the stitches in his face, and he did not even tell me. And for me, the best win I saw last year was Kuhne Boucher Kuhne. When you attack in Kuhne with 20 kilometers to go, they suspend the race. Like 3, 4, 5 teams chasing you, they cannot have you, then you're something special. When you saw Halbeke, the first thing you're thinking somebody attacking 60 kilometers out, you think, bloody idiot, how stupid can they be? Well, like Godefroot always said, to ride that stupid, you have to be very strong also. Chase him down, and he go again. Then you probably, we was not the only one who figured out maybe you have a fair chance in Flanders.
Well, Brian Holm there, kind of playing down his role in the discovery of Kasper Askelin. I think he was aware of Askelin's talent. And it was interesting to hear there that Askelin could have joined what is now EF Education Nippo back in 2018. He was all set to join the team, or very close to joining the team. But then the issue with the sponsorship falling through for the team meant that everything was up in the air, and so Askelin kind of waited and wanted to join Quickstep, and so joined them in the spring of that year, 2018. And one of the other points that Brian made about where this win has kind of come from, if you think back to last spring and Kuhne Brussels Kuhne 2020, just before everything shut down, he won that race holding off the sprinters, a bit like Jasper Stuyven did a few years ago. And, you know, that race does, it's kind of 50-50 whether it comes down to a big sprint or a small break. And, you know, it's no mean feat to hold off and win that race solo. And so it was quite interesting seeing that, you know, Jasper Stuyven won Milan-San Remo and Kasper Askelin won the Tour of Flanders. So, yeah, hearing Brian talk about this generation of Danish riders, because it's not just Askelin, is it? It's Mads Pedersen and Søren Kraut Andersen and Jonas Vingegaard, who apparently worked in a fish processing factory, getting up at 4 in the morning and going and doing a shift in there, cleaning the scales off with a knife before going training. Sounds like the sort of thing Brian Holm would approve of. Remember, he was a bricklayer, wasn't he? Would get up at 5 in the morning and lay bricks and then train in the afternoon. And one thing Brian said after I turned the tape off made me laugh. He said, you'll have to imagine the accent, but he said, these kids, they're like Sean Kelly. They all keep their feet on the ground. They're not going to move to Monaco. They're not going to get funny tattoos that they don't understand. They're not going to get a low car. They would make perfect East Germans.
So no need for Brian to bring Pozzato into it. It's a bit of a low blow. But it's been a big week, for the Koenig Quickstep chaps, hasn't it? Not just because of the Cavendish win, not just because of that milestone of 800 wins since their inception in 2003, but those contract renewals as well. You know, we've seen Asgreen have a fantastic spring. The team in general have a fantastic spring. But looking at their sort of Ardennes Classics division and also Grand Tours, big contract renewals for Julien Alaphilippe and for Remco Evenepoel as well.
But not Askreen.
And I don't know if you chaps saw or heard Patrick Lefebvre after Flanders, in typical Patrick Lefebvre sort of winking, nodding style, said, oh, Kasper, he will be more expensive now. Huh? Suggesting that a contract renewal with Askreen might be imminent. However, I understand, I have heard that Ineos Grenadiers are very, very interested in Kasper Askreen. I can't overstate that, how interested they are in Kasper Askreen.
Do they need somebody to fetch bottles for Tom Pidcock? I mean, this is crazy. I mean, it's like you know, playing Monopoly and just getting all of the stations and then all of the dark blue ones and then all of the dark green ones, all of the most valuable properties. And then what? You just own everything. Anyway, it's a strategy, I guess.
Just before we go, chaps,
it's quite a good strategy in Monopoly, to be fair.
Before we go, chaps, just on the issue of contracts, and these are two very long-term contracts again. I think Alaphilippe is till at the end of 2004. 2024, and Evenepoel is longer still, 2026 it may even be. I'm sort of always intrigued by these increasingly common, very long-term contracts for riders and how salaries and rewards are calculated, you know, so far sort of downstream. And, you know, we were talking about Pidcock earlier, and, you know, a rider like him appearing on the scene, it's a real shot across the bows of other sort of top-end, real premium Galactico-type riders, because it's a very short hop from being the absolute best rider in the world on sort of short uphill punchy finishes to being a sort of perennial disappointment. If all of a sudden Tom Pidcock proves to be better on that kind of finish than Julien Alaphilippe, then Julien Alaphilippe's market value would logically be significantly reduced. And that applies to all of these guys, whether it's Van Aert or Van der Poel or, you know, or the Grand Tour riders as well. It only takes one or two new stars to come on the scene for their market value to look very different indeed.
Are we looking at the new Tom Bonin or the new Tom Yelter Slagter? That's the question, isn't it? With Pidcock. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, it's Evenepoel. I mean, I, when I looked at that, I thought, why would you let him go at the age of 26, just when he's coming into his prime? should we wrap things up for this week, chaps? As you said, Lionel, we'll have two podcasts next week, looking back at Amstel Gold Race, then looking at Flesh Wallonne and looking ahead to Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And yeah, lots of great racing coming up. I don't want to go back over it, but you mentioned about the Basque Country being, you know, not mattering too much in the grand scheme of things. What's great about this current crop of riders is that every race really does seem to matter, you know, and Pog and Rog seemed fully invested in the Tour of the Basque Country and trying to win it. And that's what's making the racing so exciting at the moment, I think.
Yeah, well, to clarify, I was talking, you know, straight jackets off kind of thing, really, you know, loosening the top button a bit in some of these races, whereas, you know, the Tour de France is kind of, everyone's done up to 11, aren't they? The tension and the scale of it and the importance and that intensity of the racing, it is different. And so, yeah, well, my one question to you then is, who am I right in thinking that the Pog-Rog swingometer is definitely favouring Rog at the moment?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, the Basque Country was more of a... It was certainly ended up being a roglification rather than a pogcineration, didn't it?
There we go. There we go. Right, well, we'll be back next week. Thanks very much for the moment. And like I say, more friend specials coming out next week, the Young Riders Diaries. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com if you want to become a friend of the podcast. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
And thank you very much to you and not Watford, Lionel.
Thank you, Rich.